Chapter 14, Green Berets. The Special Forces A-Team camp at Tan Tri was located in Ken Thuong Province in the Mekong Delta, strategically positioned just 3 miles from Vietnam's border with Cambodia. What happened there in the summer of 1969 would become an international scandal known as the Green Beret Affair, a tragic conundrum that would raise complex questions about murder versus assassination and the mysterious relationship between the CIA and the Green Berets and about the laws of war. Most important to this story, the Green Beret Affair of 1969 demonstrates how the construct of plausible deniability shields the U.S. president from wrongdoing while exposing operators who carry out euphemistic orders vulnerable to prosecution and jail time. As per the terms of the 1954 Geneva Conference on Indochina, fighting in Cambodia was prohibited. By 1967, intelligence dictated that the communists had expanded the Ho Chi Minh Trail down into Cambodia to a terminus point on the border, just 30 miles from Saigon, called the Parrot's Beak. Starting in the spring of that same year, Mac V. Sog began running secret cross-border operations into Cambodia under the code name Daniel Boone. Detachment B-57 of the 5th Special Forces Airborne at Tan Tri provided intelligence for those and other missions under the CIA codename Project Gamma. Like so many other Green Beret paramilitary units across Vietnam, the one at Tan Tri was a hybrid of Special Forces soldiers, CIA personnel, and local indigenous soldiers. Detachment B-57 was made up of 6 Green Berets, 3 CIA operators, and as many as 450 indigenous fighters. The unit was commanded by one of the CIA operators, a 27-year-old former insurance salesman named Robert F. Marasco. He went by the cover name Captain Martin. In the winter of 1968-69, Marasco had assembled a network of 20 indigenous assets who spied for him around the Parrot's Beak. His most valuable spy, called a principal asset, was a 31-year-old native of the North named Thai Cock Chuyen. Chuyen's official position was S-5 interpreter, or TERP, in military speak. Chuyen had been recruited by CIA case officer Sergeant Alvin Smith Jr., who went by the cover name Peter Sands, and who reported to Marasco at Tan Tri. Smith was an enigmatic CIA case officer, older than Marasco by 15 years. He was also a veteran of unconventional warfare, having led covert operations behind enemy lines in Korea. According to his file, Alvin Smith once served as the only American in a battalion of 1,400 Korean and Chinese indigenous troops as part of a JAC mission that has never been fully declassified. For better or for worse, Alvin Smith was known for becoming friendly with his assets. At the nearby support base in Mak Hwa, he'd sometimes stay up late into the night drinking whiskey with Chuyen. How Chuyen spoke such good English irked Smith. Chuyen said he grew up reading books in English and that he'd worked for the U.S. military in Saigon. When pressed, Chuyen was vague about the details, claiming the missions were all classified. Now it was March 1969, and there'd been an unusual number of mortar attacks in Mak Hwa, an indicator that a bigger attack might be coming. Marasco sent a unit out on a recon mission led by a Green Beret from Kentucky named Terry McIntosh. Just 19 at the time, McIntosh was one of the youngest Green Berets assigned to the war. He'd already been in Vietnam for 7 months. It was me, Chuyen, and 10 indigenous troops on the mission, McIntosh recalled in an interview for this book. A little before dawn, I spotted enemy movement along the tree line, indicating an ambush. McIntosh fired a grenade launcher in the direction of the troops and watched the fighters disperse. He handed the scope off to Chuyen. He looked through it. I remember that he smiled. I thought that was strange but dismissed it, remembers McIntosh, who then tried calling the A camp for support, but the radio was dead. Ground-to-ground comms were usually excellent out here, he recalls. That the radio didn't work was strange to him. Suddenly, a volley of fire erupted from all sides, as if the Viet Cong had foreknowledge that the team was coming, says McIntosh. A massive firefight ensued, with McIntosh firing his assault rifle until he was out of ammunition. Chuyen was on my left, and the others to my right, but I noticed that Chuyen wasn't firing his weapon, he remembers. He was fiddling with it, and later claimed that it was jammed. At the time, I accepted his explanation without reservation. Back at the A camp, the commander heard artillery fire and ordered a mortar attack based on the unit's last known position. The firefight ended without any fatalities from Detachment B-57, and the men returned to Tan Tri. McIntosh, a radio specialist, and a teammate examined the gear. It had been tampered with, McIntosh recalls. He told Marasco, who became concerned. One of Marasco's other assets told him he'd heard Chuyen was a communist spy. Marasco ran a search in the MACV database, but there was no record of Chuyen. As a CIA employee, Marasco had access to classified information that others did not. That no record on Chuyen appeared likely meant that he was lying about having ever worked on classified missions in Saigon. Fearing he was a double agent, Marasco radioed headquarters at Nha Trang and asked that both men, Smith and Chuyen, be reassigned. Smith was moved over to the 5th Special Forces headquarters, and Chuyen returned to Saigon, where his family lived. A few weeks later, a Special Forces recon team recovered photographs of a high-level North Vietnamese Army general meeting with his local Viet Cong spies. In one of the photographs, there was Chuyen, standing right next to the North Vietnamese general, smiling. Robert Marasco was sure it was Chuyen. Alvin Smith was also shown the photograph and had the same response. It was Chuyen. Their principal asset was a spy for the North. On June 9th, CIA headquarters instructed Alvin Smith to bring Chuyen in under the guise of a covert operation. For 5 days, Chuyen was interrogated. He repeatedly failed the polygraph, all the while insisting the person in the photograph was not him. The transcript of what he actually said has never been declassified, but according to reports leaked to the press, he cursed the Americans and said they'd lose the war to the communists in the North. What to do about the double agent Chuyen? He couldn't be sent to local law enforcement. The police around the Parrot's Beak were notoriously corrupt and rife with double agents. Chuyen knew the identities of all the undercover CIA officers, operators, and assets at Tan Tri. Alvin Smith suggested they try to turn Chuyen into a triple agent, someone who could work for the CIA again. Marasco contacted the CIA station in Nha Trang and asked what he should do. He was told to kill him. Chuyen was my agent, and it was my responsibility to eliminate him with extreme prejudice, Marasco later told the New York Times. Marasco said these were oblique yet very, very clear orders. He explained further that everyone working covert operations for the CIA and special forces knew that the phrase "eliminate with extreme prejudice" was a euphemism for kill. Marasco reached out to the commander of the U.S. Army Special Forces, Colonel Robert B. Rowe, asking for his orders on the matter. Colonel Rowe told Marasco that the group was to proceed. The CIA officers and the U.S. Army Green Berets agreed on a cover story. They'd say Twin had been assigned to a covert mission and then disappeared. Everyone involved agreed to proceed, except Alvin Smith, who refused to participate. Agent Twin was told he was needed for a highly classified mission. On June 20, 1969, the CIA officer and the Green Berets drugged Twin with morphine, drove him to a remote beach near Nha Trang, and loaded him into a boat. They took the boat out into deep waters in Nha Trang Bay, where Marasco shot Twin in the head with a .22-caliber pistol equipped with a suppressor while Twin was still unconscious. The men loaded Twin's body into a mail sack, weighted it down with chains and tire rims, and threw him overboard into the South China Sea. The following day, a cable came in from CIA headquarters. "Killing is no solution," it read. Paranoia gripped CIA case officer Alvin Smith. He went to his CIA superior in Nha Trang and asked for asylum in exchange for information. With immunity in place, he told his superior officer that his colleagues at Tan Tri had killed Chuin and that now Smith feared for his own life. Things moved fast. The CIA officer notified the U.S. Army, which sent the information up the chain of command, all the way to the U.S. commander in Vietnam, General Creighton Abrams, Jr. General Abrams summoned Colonel Rowe to his office and asked what had happened to Chuin. Rowe told the general that the asset was away on a secret mission, when in fact he'd already been killed. When General Abrams learned he'd been lied to, he exploded with rage. The following day, Colonel Rowe, Robert Marasco, and six Green Berets were arrested, handcuffed, and sent to the Long Binh jail outside Saigon. They'd be tried for conspiracy to commit murder and murder in the first degree, Abrams said. The military imposed a gag order on those who knew about the case, but reporters quickly learned of the arrests and the details of their imprisonment. That American Green Berets were being held in solitary confinement, in tiny 5x7 cells with just a cot and a bare light bulb, seemed outrageous. How could the U.S. Army treat its own soldiers like this? Most shocking of all, the Secretary of the Army said that if the men were convicted, their punishment would be life in prison, not a firing squad. Firing squad? The press cried absurd. Despite the growing anti-war movement across America, a majority of civilians sided with the Green Berets, calling them scapegoats of the Pentagon war machine. More mysterious details emerged. Double agents, triple agents, Green Berets, the CIA. Then came the rumor that the Green Berets were operating across the border in Cambodia, this at a time when the Nixon White House had already insisted that a New York Times reporter who'd revealed that the United States was dropping bombs in Cambodia was a liar. When someone leaked to the press the photograph of Chuin standing next to the North Vietnamese Army general, smiling, citizens and congressmen alike began to ask questions. How could killing a Viet Cong spy in a war zone be considered a war crime? Life magazine interviewed Colonel Rowe's 11-year-old son, Robert Jr. "What's all the fuss about?" asked the fifth grader. I thought that's what Dad was in Vietnam for, to kill the Viet Cong. Henry Rothblatt, defense attorney for the Green Berets, made a brilliant move. He deposed the CIA. Marasco's identity as a CIA officer remained classified. Marasco revealed his identity to the New York Times in 1971. Rothblatt was betting that there was no way the White House would allow the CIA to testify in court. Between its ongoing assassination programs, the Phoenix program, the classified MACV SOG missions into Laos and Cambodia, these were but a few of the president's hidden hand programs that surely needed to remain that way. The president's inner circle would never allow the CIA to testify about its operations in Vietnam. The White House had far too much to lose. President Nixon had a last-minute idea, a double-cross of CIA Director Richard Helms, who Nixon disliked. In a note to Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor, Nixon wrote, "K., I think Richard Helms should be made to take part of the rap." While there's no record of Kissinger's reaction, based on actions taken, it is likely he advised the president against throwing Helms under the proverbial bus. Instead, the following morning, on September 29, 1969, the U.S. Army unexpectedly dropped all charges against the 8 men involved in the Green Beret affair. The U.S. Department of Justice concluded that a fair and impartial trial was not possible. Further details of the CIA's refusal to testify remain classified, but under pressure, the Nixon White House was forced to acknowledge that the president had been involved in the decision to drop all murder charges. Decades later, after MACV SOG was declassified, a fascinating detail emerged. On August 25th, a month after the CIA officers and the Green Berets were arrested, but before the Nixon White House dropped the murder charges, a SOG recon team called RT Florida was sent on a top-secret cross-border mission into Cambodia. There, the team was pursued by a squadron of NVA soldiers using dogs to track them. In the process of evading capture, the SOG operators shot and killed 2 NVA officers. One of the dead men turned out to be a high-ranking intelligence officer. Inside the large leather satchel he carried was a gold mine, a cache of documents, one of which was a partial roster of double agents and spies operating for Hanoi inside South Vietnam. One name on the roster was the double agent executed by order of Colonel Rowe, writes scholar Richard Schultz. "War is never pleasant," says Terry McIntosh. "War is bigger than the individual soldier. For the record, as tragic as it was for all parties, I salute Marasco and others who were charged. They were soldiers under orders. There were no good options for them. The job fell to them. The moral issues are still unresolved." It was into this highly charged environment that a young Green Beret named Louis C. Merletti volunteered to go to Vietnam. Lou Merletti stood in the green grass on the side of Interstate 95 North in Fayetteville, North Carolina, with his thumb out. It was 1969. He was 21 years old, and he was hitching a ride to the Pentagon to volunteer for service in Vietnam. His whole life was in front of him, including his plans, dreams, and aspirations of doing great things for himself, his family, and his country. But he also felt he could not do any of this in good conscience if he skipped out on Vietnam. "This war was going on, and I knew a lot of guys my age that were being drafted and didn't want to go, and they were going anyway," recalls Merletti. "I really felt like, Hey, it's not right. I have to contribute to this. I can't be sitting back here safe in the United States if these guys are going over there fighting this war. It just didn't seem to me to be fair. In 1969, the young Lou Merletti had no way of knowing what his immediate future included. He certainly had no idea that one day he would serve on the presidential protective detail of three U.S. presidents, or that he would become the 19th director of the U.S. Secret Service, a law enforcement agency created by President Abraham Lincoln and signed into law on the morning of April 14, 1865, the day of Lincoln's own assassination. The journey to war for Lou Merletti began 2 years earlier when he signed up for military service as an airborne infantryman. At the end of his first week of jump school, a very confident, very focused, physically fit young man showed up in full military dress to speak to Merletti's group of roughly 300 soldiers in training. The man wore the Green Beret. He gets up on this platform in front of us and says, "Gentlemen, I'm going to be honest with you. Special Forces is losing men, and we need volunteers," Merletti recalls. He volunteered. Training lasted 42 weeks. You learn how to treat gunshot wounds, perform surgeries and amputations. It's basically like becoming a highly trained paramedic, Merletti explains. The U.S. Army Special Forces also wanted some of its medics to speak Vietnamese. They would be treating a lot of citizens in country. And so Merletti was sent to the language school at Fort Bragg. Over the course of the next 5 months, for 8 hours a day, he was taught Vietnamese by a lively young woman originally from North Vietnam. By the time he finished training, he had less than 1 year on his 3-year enlistment. "I was told I didn't have to go to Vietnam," he remembers. "It was too close to the end of his tour, unless I volunteered." This is why he was hitchhiking to the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., that spring day in 1969. Merletti had been standing on the side of the road in full dress uniform with his Green Beret for about 5 minutes when a man in a VW Bug pulled up, slowed to a stop, and rolled down the window. "Where are you going?" the man asked. "The Pentagon," Merletti said. It was the height of the Vietnam War. It was also the height of the anti-Vietnam War movement. The country was terribly divided. Lou Merletti had a feeling that the outcome here, with the driver of the VW Bug, could go either way. "The Pentagon? Are you kidding me?" the man asked, incredulous. Lou said he was not kidding, that he was going there to volunteer for combat service in Vietnam. "Well, if you're going to the Pentagon," the driver said, "I'll take you straight there." And he did. Nearly 50 years later, Merletti vividly remembers being dropped off in the parking lot of the Pentagon, and he still thinks about the anonymous man who drove him there, the man's willingness to help do his part, however incremental. There in Washington, D.C., inside Defense Department headquarters, Merletti located Mrs. Billy Alexander, just as Billy Waugh had sought out and found Mrs. Alexander when he wanted to get assigned to SOG. Everyone knew Billy Alexander was in charge of assigning volunteers to special forces in Vietnam, remembers Merletti. And, as she had for so many others, she approved his request. "You'll be in Vietnam in August," she said. To get to Vietnam, Merletti first flew from his hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to Chicago, Illinois, where he had a layover. He traveled in his Class A dress uniform and Green Beret. "You really stood out as a soldier back then," Merletti recalls. "No one else in the entire military was authorized to wear a beret. There was only the Green Beret." Then, to his surprise, as he approached the gate, Merletti spotted a fellow Green Beret. But it wasn't just anyone, It was his very good friend from Special Forces Training 7th Group, Mike Karopis. He was saying goodbye to his family, so I kind of held back, he remembers. Eventually, Mike Karopis spotted Merletti, and he introduced him to his family, a group of whom had come to the airport to see him off to war. I met everybody, and then it was time to go, to get on the plane, recalls Merletti, to go fight the war in Vietnam. On the airplane, a strange thing happened. Merletti and Karopis were sitting together in the front of the plane. The flight attendants began to serve lunch, Merletti recalls. They put a meal in front of me, and then they said to Mike, "We'll get you a meal in a minute." 5 or so minutes passed before the flight attendant returned. She says, "We're really sorry, but we don't have any meals left. But here's a little voucher, so the next time you fly, you'll get an upgrade or something like that." Mike Karopis looked at the voucher. He looks at me, remembers Merletti, and he says, "You know, this is a bad omen." And I say, "What do you mean?" He says, "I'm not coming back." I say, "Mike, don't say that. Don't say that at all." I said, "You know, we all have those thoughts, but don't go there. Just don't do it." Mike Karopis looked squarely at Lou Merletti and said, "No, I know I'm not coming back." When they arrived in country, Merletti, Karopis, and the rest of the Green Berets were taken to the island facility of Hon Tre, off the coast of Vietnam. There, Special Forces soldiers coming from the United States for insertion into the battlefield generally spent several days getting a refresher course in shooting, using hand grenades, setting off claymore mines, and the use of mortars. When the training on Hon Tre was over, the group traveled to Special Forces headquarters at Nha Trang. They tell us, "Okay, everybody, fall out. You have your orders." We lined up and were standing at attention, and they begin calling names off and telling you where you're going. Merletti heard the sergeant say his name. "Merletti, A-502. This meant he'd been assigned to Detachment A 502 of the 5th Special Forces Group. The detachment's mission was to advise and assist the Vietnamese Special Forces in the joint CIA-Pentagon program, the Civilian Irregular Defense Group. Lou Merletti remembers thinking to himself, "Hey, that's not a bad assignment." Then he heard Mike Karopis' name being called out and the assignment he'd been given. "Karopis, CCC. Merletti remembers thinking to himself, "Oh, God." Everyone knew that CCC was part of MACV-SOG. The acronym CCC stood for Command and Control Central, one of what were now 3 SOG bases in South Vietnam. Special Forces soldiers who were new to the program knew SOG was the place where hardcore warriors with extensive combat experience fought direct action missions behind enemy lines. SOG was where Special Forces legends like Larry Thorne, Ed Walkoff, and Billy Waugh fought and thrived, some until they died. But for newcomers, for initiates into combat, SOG was dangerous. It was suicide on the ground. Merletti tried to make light of Karopis' assignment, but found the reality of the situation difficult to accept. "I volunteered for Vietnam," he recalls. "I don't think Mike Karopis had. I believe he'd received orders to go. I knew he didn't want to go to SOG, to CCC," remembers Merletti. "But I knew he'd give it his best." The sergeant in charge announced that helicopters would be arriving momentarily to take everyone to their specific destinations. "The formation breaks up," says Merletti, and Mike, who is standing maybe 2 people down from me, he steps over and he puts out his hand and he says, "Hey, thank you for your friendship and everything. It's been wonderful." He said, "I really appreciate you being my friend, but this is it. It's over." And I said, "Please, Mike, don't say that." And he says, "No, no, no, it's going to happen. It's gonna happen. It's all right. Loomer Letty got on one Army helicopter, and Mike Karopis got on another Army helicopter. Either right before the birds flew away, or as they were taking off, Merletti either said out loud to Mike Karopis, or he said to himself, "No, I'll meet you back here in 1 year." Lou Merletti was sent to a small village called Trung Dong in the Central Highlands, a remote area at risk of being dominated by the Viet Cong. He lived in a Special Forces A camp there, built earlier by Green Berets. His team consisted of 12 Americans and a unit of indigenous mercenaries called CIDG Strikers, being paid by the Department of Defense to defend their village and to stop the enemy from gaining further control of the area. "I had not been exposed to combat," Merletti remembers, "and on the very first night there was an ambush. In the ensuing firefight, 6 Viet Cong were killed, and one of the mercenaries was bitten by a poisonous snake, which Merletti treated in the field and had medevaced out, thanks to the guidance," he says, "of teammate Sergeant John Deschamps." Some weeks later, he and the team were out on patrol in the dense jungle when the CIDG striker standing right next to him was shot in the head. "My immediate reaction," says Merletti, "was, I've got to get help. Then I realized I was the help." After a few intense and shock-riddled moments, Merletti's Special Forces medical training kicked in. "I knew exactly what to do," he recalls. "I said to myself, I can do this. I was trained for this." And he did. He stopped the bleeding, wrapped the wound, and again oversaw the medevac. For the better part of the year, Merletti served in combat as part of a Special Forces A team. "Every time you go out on patrol, you have a lump in your throat," he recalls. "You wonder, is this it? Every footstep you take, you know it could be your last footstep." To stay focused and not let his mind wander, when he went out on patrol, Merletti learned to pay attention to minute details. Every detail mattered. If he wasn't paying attention, he could cross a tripwire or step on a landmine or make a noise that might alert the enemy. You couldn't let your mind drift. You couldn't think, "Man, I wish I were at the ballpark. I wish I had a cold lemonade or a beer in my hand." Do that and you're dead. You learn to look at the ground in front of you, to look at your flank. Pay attention to every single detail, every moment of every day. Merletti's 1 year tour of duty was scheduled to come to an end on May 30th, 1970. But in the spring of 1970, the Defense Department announced it was reducing troop numbers in Vietnam at President Nixon's request, and all soldiers were being given what was called a 30-day drop. And so, in the first week of April 1970, Lou Merletti learned he was scheduled to leave Vietnam on April 28. All across Vietnam, Green Berets received the same news, and that included Mike Karopis, who for 10 straight months now had been fighting intense, direct-action missions on a recon team for SOG CCC. On the morning of April 15, 1970, trouble began near a Special Forces A camp at Dak Sang in the Central Highlands, 10 miles from the border with Laos. Intelligence showed a massive buildup of NVA forces was underway, positioned to overtake the camp and surrounding valley. The plan was to insert a battalion of Special Forces soldiers and their ARVN counterparts on top of the mountain to protect the camp and all it stood for. One of the soldiers who fought there described this hilltop as little more than a bald knob with craters. But it was a strategic position with a vantage point over the surrounding valley. The U.S. Army and the North Vietnamese Army each wanted to control it. Designated LZ Orange, the Defense Department would initiate an offensive move to control it. So it was that at 04:30 in the morning of April 15th, the flight line at Quantum Airfield came alive with pilots, crew chiefs, and gunners busying themselves with their pre-flight checks, mounting weapons, and loading rocket pods, recalled Donald Summers, a member of the 170th Assault Helicopter Company. He was about to be inserted. As the sun rose, the offensive began. As at Oscar 8, helicopter gunships cleared LZ Orange, while two troop transport helicopters ferried in South Vietnamese soldiers and their U.S. Special Forces commanders. The first helicopter landed, and its crew charged out. Then, in a move perfected by the North Vietnamese Army, as the second helicopter hovered 50 feet over the landing zone, it was rocketed out of the air, killing 9 of the 12 men on board. On the ground, there were 8 South Vietnamese soldiers and 5 American soldiers who'd survived, including one pilot, one co-pilot, a door gunner, a pathfinder, and the crew chief. U.S. Air Force fast flyers came in screeching overhead, laying down suppressive fire. Over the past several hours, the losses in the area had been staggering. 4 helicopters shot down, 7 helicopters hit, fate unknown. One of the A-1E Sky Raiders was last seen losing altitude above a ridgeline, its engine on fire. It was at this point in the operation that the U.S. Army and the U.S. Air Force Command assessed the operation from headquarters and decided a rescue mission was not possible without an unacceptable further loss of life. Which is when a SOG bright light team operating out of Con Tum was asked to volunteer for a rescue mission. Like firefighters running into a burning building, Staff Sergeant Mike Karopis, Staff Sergeant Dennis Neal, and 6 Montagnard mercenaries volunteered for the job. The operational plan was to insert the bright light team onto LZ Orange to rescue the men trapped on the hill. Bill McDonald of the 170th Assault Helicopter Company volunteered to pilot the team into the target area. Helicopter pilot Donald Summers was one of the men bleeding out and dying on the hill. He later recalled seeing the helicopter carrying the SOG bright light team on its approach. Roughly half a mile out from the landing zone, pilot Bill McDonald dropped his SOG helicopter into a deep dive and headed down to the valley floor. He had to fly in, low and fast, up the side of the mountain to the LZ, Summers recalled, or he would have been shot down long before he got anywhere near the hill. He was taking extensive fire from 360 degrees, but he pressed on. Crippled from enemy gunfire, but still flying, Summers watched, horrified. The bird slammed into the landing zone. Fuel poured out of a large hole in the fuel cell. A rocket had lodged near the tail but not exploded. Under a barrage of small arms fire, Summers and the other survivors ran toward the helicopter. Summers remembered reaching the aircraft and looking inside. There, SOG bright light team members, Mike Karopis, Dennis Neal, and the 6 Montagnards lay dead on the floor, shredded from multiple gunshot wounds. Summers climbed into the crippled helicopter, and by some strange aviation miracle, Bill McDonald was able to fly the helicopter away. 13 days later, on April 28th, Lou Merletti completed his service in Vietnam. He was helicoptered down from the A-team camp at Trung Dong to Special Forces headquarters in Nha Trang. The first action he took was to walk up to the bulletin board and search for Mike Karopis' name. He found it. It read, Michael Vincent Karopis, killed in action, April 15th, 1970. Merletti felt crushing loss. Standing there, I became overwhelmed with emotion, he recalls. The reality set in. I thought about Mike, and I still think about all the guys who died in Vietnam, each one of them. They were alive one moment, and then they got shot. There's no anesthesia on the battlefield. You get shot. It's incredibly painful to get shot. You bleed out before you die, Merletti says. Standing in front of Mike Karopas's name, Merletti made a vow. I wanted to try to live up to certain expectations of myself, for him, for Mike. Merletti vowed that moving forward in his life, were he to perceive something in front of him as difficult, he would stop and think of Mike Karopas. He would acknowledge that whatever problem he was having the problem because he was alive. Mike Karopas would not have the luxury of problems. Mike Karopas, age just 22, was dead. By the end of 1970, the war was all but lost, the human losses too great to bear. The mighty U.S. Defense Department could not win the war. There were no front lines. The enemy swarmed like bees, like ants crawling, or fish swimming, just as Mao Zedong warned in On Guerrilla Warfare, and General Giap had echoed in his own manifesto. The communists dominated the geography of every environment. For much of the war, the Defense Department believed its helicopters could tip the balance of power. But by 1971, helicopter losses were insurmountable, too. The precise number of helicopters shot down during the Vietnam War remains classified as of 2019. Still, the Defense Department was not ready to accept their loss, and several 11th-hour attempts were made within SOG before 1971 to develop new tactics to win a guerrilla war. Billy Waugh was at the locus of one of these new ideas, insertion by parachute in an unorthodox manner. It was to be called a halo jump. This involved exiting an aircraft above 10,000 feet, free-falling to roughly 2,000 feet or even lower, then gliding to the earth using a steerable parachute. During the Korean War, General Jack Singlob had practiced this tactic himself as a possible insertion technique to use in the covert air operations he was in charge of for the CIA. But the tactic was never used in Korea. In 1970, the halo jump remained untested in war. Since World War II, paratroopers had always jumped into battle using static lines that would open the parachutes automatically, predictably, one after the next, so a large group of jumpers could land in a pattern on a drop zone. Vietnam was different. SOG recon teams knew the NVA didn't keep watch over landing zones at night because no one ever parachuted in the darkness until now. Waugh was in charge of selecting the world's first combat halo team, then overseeing all SOG halo training, including of the Indige fighters assigned to operations. The units practiced on a tiny islet just a few miles off the northwest coast of Okinawa called Lishima Island. There, SOG operators practiced jumping out of aircraft at 30,000 feet in full combat gear, then performing a military free fall for 27,500 feet, reaching terminal velocity before pulling the ripcord and landing in the ocean. The attempt to train their Indige counterparts was a tall order, remembers Waugh. The Green Berets were all airborne qualified. Some, like Waugh, had been jumping out of airplanes for more than 20 years. None of the Indige had ever left Vietnam, let alone jumped out of an airplane with a parachute. Half of our Indige had never seen the ocean before, recalls Waugh. One of our guys got spooked and pulled his parachute right after he jumped. He missed the target by about 10 miles. By the time we got him into the rescue boat, he'd already consumed about a gallon of seawater. He got very, very sick. On November 28, 1970, SOG's first HALO team, RT Virginia, jumped into Laos. The unit was led by Staff Sergeant Cliff Newman, Sergeant First Class Sammy Hernandez, and Sergeant First Class Melvin Hill, accompanied by an officer with the ARVN and two Montagnard mercenaries, who had no experience jumping but did just fine, remembers Waugh. RT Virginia conducted 5 days of reconnaissance behind enemy lines and were exfiltrated without incident. This was the first known HALO combat jump in the history of warfare. 7 months later, on June 22, 1971, Billy Waugh led the third HALO jump team into combat, also into Laos. Teammate Madison Stroheim was captured and killed. The vertical wind tunnel at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School at Fort Bragg was named in his honor. But no amount of new thinking and no number of unusual infiltration tactics could salvage this unwinnable war. The following year, on May 1, 1972, SOG was disbanded. American citizens were fed up with violence and warfare. In January 1973, the Paris Peace Accords were signed, bringing an end to the Vietnam War, with the country to remain divided between the North and the South. With 58,000 Americans killed in Vietnam, guerrilla warfare was a dirty word. Across the military and intelligence communities, budgets were slashed. Across the CIA and the Defense Department, covert action programs were disbanded. The U.S. Army in general and the U.S. Special Operations Forces in particular suffered a black eye. Four of the Army's 6 Special Forces groups were inactivated. The 2 small units that remained were assigned to a program called Spartan, Special Proficiency at Rugged Training and Nation Building. To stay active, its soldiers worked with Indian tribes in Florida, Arizona, and Montana, helping to build roads and medical facilities. The U.S. Army vowed to concentrate on conventional warfare, to stay out of ungovernable places like the jungles in Southeast Asia, and to instead prepare for infantry and tank warfare on the flatlands of Central Europe. Men like Billy Waugh and the skills they possessed were not needed by the U.S. military or intelligence services anymore. The Army offered Waugh a desk job at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. Waugh knew after more than 10 years of covert action and direct action combat operations that office work was not for him. In lieu of a retirement ceremony, he and 6 Green Berets HALO jumped out of an aircraft over Fort Bragg, pulling their parachutes 800 feet above parade grounds. They landed, packed up their parachutes, and spent the afternoon drinking beer in honor of their dead friends. Then they went home. Back from Vietnam, Lou Merletti enrolled in Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He would earn his 4-year degree in a little over 3 years. One day before he graduated, he was walking through the student center when he caught sight of a notice on a bulletin board. NSA hiring, the notice read. He took the test being offered to new recruits, aced it, and was called in for an interview. Inside the foyer of a fancy building, he followed instructions that took him up an elevator to the 35th floor. I walked around. There didn't seem to be anybody in any of the offices, but eventually I located the correct room, Merletti recalls. Seated behind a desk was a man. After some small talk, the man spoke candidly. "We're an intelligence gathering agency," he said. We're larger than the CIA. We want to offer you a job. Merletti asked why the NSA, an intelligence agency, was interested in recruiting him, a former Green Beret. After an exchange of words, I realized the recruiter was interested in my language capabilities, that I spoke Vietnamese. The man told Merletti that if he were to work for NSA, it would be a solid career. But a job with an intelligence agency was not what Lou Merletti had in mind for his future. The war was over, he remembers thinking. How long were we going to be spying on the Vietnamese? Merletti told the recruiter that he was interested in finding a long-term and fulfilling career. The NSA recruiter asked Merletti what it was he wanted to do. I feel that I'm really good at protecting people and saving lives, Merletti recalls telling him. That's what I'd like to do. You should join the Secret Service, the man said. Lou Merletti had never considered a career with the U.S. Secret Service, but it made sense. He had the skills of a special forces soldier and the heart and soul of a protector. After two interviews with the Secret Service, he was hired. He thought about how awesome it felt to work for the agency that protected the President of the United States. Assassination was as old as warfare and would never go away. For Billy Waugh, the transition to a civil career was not easy. In need of a paycheck, he took a job at one of the few federal institutions that was hiring combat veterans without prejudice, the U.S. Postal Service. In the fall of 1972, he reported for duty at a post office in Austin, Texas, 20 miles from where he was born. Waugh rose up through the ranks. With the discipline of a Green Beret and a desire to excel, he moved from mail carrier to the person who oversaw the automated mail sorting machine. Let's face it, recalls Waugh, for a person like me, post office work is worse than death. Billy Waugh was 43. He'd spent 25 years of his life as a soldier, half of them in combat. In an interview in 2017, he shared a rare emotional moment about what he was thinking at that time. I do not ever recall feeling fear, not up to that moment in my life, not in combat before, and not anywhere since. But there in the post office, I feared my life was over, he remembers, that I would wind up some old man drinking at the end of the bar. For 5 long years, Billy Waugh continued to work for the Postal Service, until one night, in July 1977, the telephone rang. He answered it, and recognized the voice on the other end of the line. It belonged to a covert action operator he had worked with in SOG, in Vietnam. The man asked Billy if he was ready for action, if he wanted back in. Waugh said yes.